So during the book of Melachim, we're up to what they call the third chapter, Melachim Aleph. You guys know that it's a Christian invention to divide Melachim into A and B, and to divide it into these chapters, but it's useful, so we use it as a reference. Paro's daughter comes to Israel. Shlomo marries her, and he builds her a beautiful palace. He obviously converts her. He doesn't marry a non-Jewish girl, as he does all the other women he marries. And their conversions are not so sincere, ultimately. As we find, towards the end, they go back to their pagan ways. The verse chastises Shlomo. And as always, we say that although the verse expresses it one way, we have to know that these giants were so much higher than us. We have to know how to take that. I'm with you, Yosef, but only if it's short, because we have a lot to cover tonight.
Three generations of Egyptians.
Right. Good question. Remind me to get back that Thursday, Bezat Shem. Shlomo is faithful to Hashem, and he goes to Givon, and Hashem appears to him and asks him, what would you like? And Shlomo says, you did such kindness with my father, you gave him this kingdom, you gave me the kingdom after him, and now I have to run the kingdom, and the king's job was to judge the people, and it's very hard. So do me a favor. Hashem, give me the capacity to understand things quickly and do them correctly. And Hashem liked the fact that that's what Shlomo asked for. And so Hashem said, being that you didn't ask for gold and silver, you didn't ask to conquer your enemies, you asked for the capacity to do fair, to rule justly, so I will give you what you wanted, you will understand everything, and you will be smarter like none before you or any that come after you. And I'll give you even the stuff you didn't ask for, the wealth, the honor, that no king like you has ever been in your time. And if you stick to my Torah and my mitzvos, and this is the great big if, that's the big challenge in life, if you do stick to my Torah and mitzvos, Hashem tells him, the way your father did, I will give you longevity. And when Shlomo awakens and realizes it was a dream, but he realizes he understands the birds chirping, he goes and brings tremendous sacrifices because he was given this gift of knowledge. And from this party that Shlomo throws, we derive the halacha that when a person accomplishes a large amount of Torah, they should make a siyum. The halacha of making a siyum is learned from Shlomo. He wakes up one morning and suddenly he knows all this vast amount of knowledge. So when you gain a lot of knowledge, anytime you reach a stopping point, you finish a masechta, you finish a book of Tanakh you've been working on for a long time. So when you finish something substantial, so then you make a party. When you finish it, it's brought in the Shulchan Aruch and the halachas of Talmud Torah. And then we're told the famous story about the two women of ill repute who come before Shlomo, and woman number one starts talking. And for lack of names, we'll call her woman number one. She says, I and this woman, we're alone at home. And we both gave birth alone at home. And on the third day, so I gave birth, and then on the third day she gave birth, and we're together at home. So the babies are tiny, and there's no one there except for us two at home. And her baby died at night because she lay on it. So woman number one is doing the talking. When woman number one stated, there's no one but me and her, she already sealed the case halachically, because it's her word against hers. And she says, so her son died at night, and she got up in the middle of the night and took my son as I was sleeping and put him by her bosom and put her dead son by me. So who's holding the dead son? Woman number one. Who's doing the talking? Woman number one. Woman number one is making the claims. Woman number two hasn't said a word. Halachically, woman number two doesn't have to say a word. Shlomo could say, go home, Mrs. Yeah, woman of ill repute, whatever. Not Mrs., unfortunately, right? But the case is really closed. Woman number one has sealed her own fate halachically by saying there are no witnesses and no one knows, it's just me and her. Okay, your word against her. You're holding the dead baby. You want to take the live baby from her? Prove it's yours. You can't prove it. That's it. There's nothing we can do to help you. But She continues and says, I got up in the morning to nurse the boy, and he's dead. So I waited till there was more light. I looked at him, and I see, that's not my boy. So only now does woman number two open her mouth. Halachically, the case is closed. There's nothing to talk about. But she doesn't know that. So woman number two says, no, my son's the live one. Your son's the dead one. Woman number one says, no, your son's the dead one. My son's the live one. What does Shlomo hear? And Shlomo says, woman number two is saying, my son's the live one, your son's the dead one. What does it mean? She's stressing. The first thing she's claiming is, my son's alive. What's the other one saying? No, your son's the dead one. If she was really concerned about her, what would her real mother say? Her first concern would be, my son is alive. Not that your son is dead, but that my son is alive. Shlomo says, listen, what are they saying? But Shlomo has to prove it. So this 12-year-old kid, he's the judge. You see, I'll tell you my own thought. I say, I didn't see this anywhere, but I say, who knows how many people came to him for justice? You know, he's a little kid. Maybe only two women like this came to him in the beginning. But, because after this, it says the nation appreciated his wisdom. So this is my own shot. That, yeah, okay, two women like this, it ends up in front of the king. So, he says, bring me a sword. They bring him a sword. Shlomo has the sword. And the sword is there before him. And he says, okay, cut the child in two. Give her half and give her half. So the Navi now tells us, woman number two, whose son was really the live one, she said to the king, out of mercy for her kid, she says, please, my master, give her the live son. Don't kill him. And woman number one, and now you understand why it was important to know that these were the lowest women of society. Woman number one says, no, no, that's fair. Okay. So the king yells and says, give her the live one. Obviously, she's the mother. Now, this concept that a Bezdin can trick people, that's something we do all the time. We don't always have to play innocent. When people come before us, the Talmud tells us there was once the wife of someone's wife who was a servant formerly, who was a freed servant. So halachically, you wouldn't give her sota waters. And it was suspected that she cheated on her husband. So she didn't know that halachically they couldn't give her the sota waters. She didn't know exactly how they administer the sota waters. So the rabbis in the court, they said, oh, you're saying you didn't cheat on your husband? Really? We're going to prepare the waters. Go prepare the waters. So now they go and they bring some to us and they start mixing it and they say, oh boy, you know what's going to happen? No one starts shaking and you know they're sitting there very seriously. And as they build the tension in the room and they say, you sure you want to drink it? I really feel bad for you. If, you know, as they're playing the role. And then there wasn't sota waters. Sota waters has to be in the Beis HaMikdash. Wasn't in the Beis HaMikdash. Sota waters has to be with the coin. There wasn't a coin. They didn't do anything for real. But she didn't know any of these halachas. You know, what does she know? Says they come to her with the cup. Says, no, not anything but the cup. Don't give me the cup. No. I admit. Okay, fine. It wasn't sota waters. Okay. That's a story that's run in the Mishnah. We have many times that the courts have to, you got to get to the truth. So the nation heard of Shlomo's wisdom and now the nation was scared of him because they saw that this was godly wisdom that was within him and that he would get to the truth whether they liked it or not. And just last week we learned the fantastic story of the three merchants who came before him and no one knew. One of them had cheated all the others, stolen everyone else's money, but everyone thought it was someone else and no one knew what the truth was. And now Shlomo outsmarted them and discovered who was the thief. So you guys can see that. Those of you who weren't here, it's in Sefer Maasiyot. It must be last week. You could just go online. You'll see it's one of the last stories in Sefer Maasiyot. So the Navi then tells us his officers, who was his chief general, who was his tax collector. The Navi describes how he divided the country and how he divided the taxes. All of that to us, I mean, it's important, like every Pasuk in Torah, but we're not going to go into that. Now, The Navi tells us that all the nations were subservient to Shlomo. They'd pay him taxes. And the Navi describes the tremendous amounts of food that were made in his home, and the tremendous number of horses, 40,000 stables. He had 12,000 horsemen. And Chazal tell us that Shlomo transgressed. The Torah says, Lo yar belo nashim, lo yar belo susim, chesed v'zav lo yar belo meod. He has three commandments, the king. Not to have too much money, not to have too many wives, not to have too many horses. And on these commandments, the Torah tells us that each one, there's a logic behind it. His heart shouldn't go astray. The women shouldn't lead him astray. The horses shouldn't lead him to going back to making pacts or sending people to Egypt where they breed horses. And Shlomo HaMelech said, well, if that's the reason, I could do it and I won't have those problems. And Shlomo HaMelech fell on each one. Each one ended up playing itself out exactly the way the Torah said it would. And the lesson we learned from it, the Midrash says, is that this explains to us why Hashem didn't reveal the reasons of mitzvos. Because it's like you tell a child, don't play next to the railing, you might fall. He says, no, I won't fall. Right? You know why you're telling him not to play there. He knows why he thinks he knows better. Until he falls, he doesn't realize that you were right. The same thing the Torah. If the Torah were to tell us the reasons, so we'd always say, well, if that's the reason, then I could do it and I'll be okay. And that's what happened. Shlomo HaMelech and Chazal say the lesson is, if the wisest of men had three mitzvos where the Torah actually does explain the reason, and you see what happened, he said, oh, I could do it and I'll be okay. So then what would happen if any of us would understand the logic behind any of the mitzvos? So, Shlomo's very, very smart, as the Pesukim tell us. And Navi tells us he spoke 3,000 Mishalim and wrote 1,500 songs. And he was able to speak to the trees. He knew everything under the sun. He knew how to talk about trees. He knew how to understand where to plant which tree. There's a special wisdom that the Medrash says there are veins in the earth. Going from the Temple Mount, there are veins of nutrients that go, and that's why certain countries can grow certain things, and that's why here in Israel they were able to grow things that they couldn't grow anywhere else in the world. And even today, that's the case. So the Medrash explains that there are veins, and they go to different countries, so different countries can grow different things, and they stem from the Temple Mount. Shlomo knew how to taste. The Medrash says that the men, before the flood, they knew how to taste the earth and know what to plant in that earth. Shlomo knew that too. He knew how to understand the creatures of the earth, the different animals and their barking and their howling or whatever they did. And nations all heard he was so smart, they'd all send emissaries to see how smart he was. And those of you who want, we have probably in the special classes online on torahforme.org, we have a whole medrash about the Queen of Sheba's visit. And when she came to Shlomo one Thursday night, the guys wanted to hear that. There's a whole story about how he tricked her, and she thought she'd trick him, and he tricked her. He made a place seem like it was filled with water, and she was tricked by that. One thing after another, very interesting medrash, how he outsmarted her. Hiram, the king of Tzor, sends his servants, and Shlomo tells him, you know, I've heard you guys are so good at building things, help me out. I want to build a temple. And so Hiram works with him. They have great cedar trees up in the north. And so Hiram works with him to build the trees. And he's very fond of Shlomo. He admires Shlomo's wisdom. And the commentaries comment that this was a mistake on Shlomo's behalf, to have the temple built by non-Jews. And the commentaries say that was one of the reasons that the temple didn't last. That the temple, whatever was built by Jewish workers lasted. And whatever was built by imported labor, so that didn't last. So the Navi also goes into the great amounts of gold and the different things that he'd pay with. And the nation was very heavily taxed, which is always a problem. So even though in Shlomo's time they didn't dare say anything, but this is already breeding ground for problems. The Navi describes the way they had shifts out in Lebanon. A person was given 2 months at home and 1 month out at work in Lebanon, 10,000 people. And the Navi describes that he had many, many people carrying the stones. And here there's a fascinating discussion in the Talmud. The Talmud says, Shlomo put Jews to work. You're described 70,000 people carrying stones and wood, and another 80,000 people cutting stones out of the mountains. So There's a Gemara which you got to hear out, because if I'm going to say the first line of the Gemara, a lot of you are going to be offended. So you have to hear the second line of the Gemara, and then you might still be offended. But at least you'll be less offended. So the Gemara says, no, Shlomo didn't do that. Shlomo had foreign workers coming in. So what's going on here? There were a lot of people that when they heard about the wealth in Shlomo's time, they said, we want to become Gerim. And the courts at the time, they said, you guys aren't for real. You're attracted to the money. So we're not going to accept you. So they said, no, we want to come anyways. So they said, okay, you want to come, go work on the mountains. Go work carrying, let's see. So that's the simple reading. The Gemara first says, no, Shlomo didn't let Jews do that. He let Gerim do that. That's why I said you'd be offended if I said it. But when you know the continuation of the Gemara, it's not that he let Gerim do that. He let people who came, who they verified were not sincere, and then they said, you know, guys, we're sorry. You're not for real. And if you're not for real, you want to do something, here's what you could do. And it's very interesting. The Gemara says they were right, that they weren't for real. And yet 70,000 people carrying and 80,000 people working, cutting stones out of the mountains, and yet they weren't for real. You know, that's interesting. Sometimes you think if a person's willing to do the effort, then he's for real. I don't know. Maybe they also made a lot of money doing that. It was hard work, but they made a lot of money. Yeah?
Didn't you say that the Jews build last, but the non-Jews build didn't last?
Right.
So if non-Jews cut the stone and the trees,
right?
What's going to last?
Right. That's what he said. This was a mistake by Shlomo, right? This was part of the mistake. This is also the opening to a big discussion in Talmud that discusses that when Mashiach comes, we're not going to accept Gerim. There are different Midrashim. There are Midrashim that say all the nations will become Gerim. There are Midrashim that say that we won't accept Gerim. Why? Because everyone's going to want to come just for the money. Everyone's going to say, you know, it's a worthwhile thing. Why not? So the Gemara over here says the Sanhedrin didn't accept all these Gerim. It was lower courts that accepted them. So the first question is, who needs the Sanhedrin for a Ger? Ger doesn't need a Sanhedrin. He needs three rabbis who are prominent enough to be on a Beis Din. And then he could become a Ger. He doesn't need a Sanhedrin. And secondly, if the Sanhedrin refused, then who agreed? And if they agreed, then what validity did it have? And if the Sanhedrin knew about it, then why didn't they shut them down? So this is all a big discussion in the Gemara. Meaning the Gemara opens up a very interesting sugya about the whole story of Gir. Because the Gemara starts talking about Beis Din Shel Hedyotos, which is a big discussion in Rishonim over here. What is the Beis Din Shel Hedyotos? Who were these people who said, we'll be Megari, we know the courts don't approve, but we'll do it anyways. Who were they? So that's a discussion in Tosus over there. It's a big discussion in Halacha. It happens to be, people don't quote it, but the biggest machmir in all these sugiyot of Giyul was Rav Kook. Rav Kook Zatzal held that if someone's not sincere, and Rav Kook was very, very strong against, everyone agrees if someone's not sincere, it's not valid. But Rav Kook held that we have to be very, very careful and very, very stringent on this. But the Rabbanut doesn't go with Rav Kook on this, by the way. This one, they don't go with Rav Kook. Yeah. Yevamot. Yeah. So they carried these tremendous stones, and here where we reach what they call the sixth chapter, so we have an interesting pasuk because it is a pasuk that denotes the time from Yetzias Mitzrayim. So it's a very important pasuk for history. When we want to gauge when things are in history, this is one of the pivotal psukim. The pasuk says it was 480 years after the Jews left Mitzrayim. So now you have to start doing the math. 480 years is when Shlomo HaMelech built the temple. Now you have to start working backwards and fit in the period of the Shoftim, the 40 years in the desert. You know, you take off 40 years for David, 40 years for the desert. And then you start working your way backwards and you start trying to piece everything together. Because this is, you don't have, from the beginning, from almost the beginning, from the Chumash till now, you don't have such a good marker. So Shlomo builds the Beit HaMikdash. And then we have many, many chapters describing the size and the length and the width and the engravings and the colors on the walls and the colors on the curtains and the layers of wood and all that we can't go into. But you guys are welcome to take, they have good picture books. You'll have a very good picture of the first Beit HaMikdash. Even though the picture books can't be accurate because we have things that we ourselves don't know exactly how they were built. One of the famous things that Shlomo built was the Yam Shel Shlomo. He built a special, huge basin, like a huge bath, that could have 2,000 people in it in one shot. It says Alpaim Bat Yachil. Bat doesn't mean a girl. Bat is a measurement of a human being. And he built also his own Kruvim. And that means that aside from the Kruvim, the figurines of angels that you had in the Holy of Holies on the Aron, you also had Kruvim that Shlomo built. Discussion how many exactly there were and where they were located, but it seems like there were at least two more angels, two more figurines of angels in the Holy of Holies. So you say to yourself, wait a second, how could you do that? And the answer is that from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu all the way through Shlomo HaMelech, there was a tradition, a brisa that we still have, or at least we have parts of it, I don't know if what we have is complete, a brisa called Brisa Demleches HaMishkan. The brisa of how you're supposed to build a Mishkan and how you're supposed to build a Beis HaMikdash, and how we have. These are different traditions we have. And it's just like we have the Mishnah, they had an oral tradition on what's supposed to be in a Beis HaMikdash. Aside from which, then Shlomo Mel's time, they had either he was a Navi, we brought the Machlok Shushonim last time, or they also had other Navim. So with Navim, you could do things, but at the end of the day, we have to realize that you can't make a change in the temple without risking doing Avodah Zarah. So the only way he could do it was because he had this tradition on how you're supposed to build the Beis HaMikdash. Yes?
Navim?
Navim means prophets.
Yeah,
so there were prophets at the time. So if a prophet tells them, look, this is how Hashem wants it, a temple has to be built based on a prophet. It's one of the problems we have today. Even if we could figure everything else out, you need a prophet to tell you what to do. So when you have a prophet there, it makes things easier. And I want to thank you for asking. Guys, that's one of the things you need to help me with. Sometimes I assume people know a word, and they don't. And I can't always remember to translate each word. So you have to stop me and tell me. Right. Right. I appreciate it, and please keep stopping me if I say words in Hebrew and I don't translate them. Shlomo built a vine of gold, and somehow he made this gold develop leaves of gold and clusters of gold, and the leaves would fall down and they would be there for the poor. So you'll ask me how he did it. I can't tell you. I'm going to say I don't know. But maybe I do, but I still can't tell you. So Shlomo did many fantastic things in the Beit HaMikdash. It says the architects in the Second Temple couldn't figure out how he built some of his walls, where he had walls that were thin and yet very tall. And they didn't know how to build that well. They don't know how he got the water to travel that high. They don't know Shlomo HaMelech. When he built the walls, so he built them so that two interesting things he did. One thing, the walls, being that they were so tall, he made it that as the wall went up, it got thinner and thinner, slightly thinner. So that if you stood under the wall and looked up, you didn't feel like maybe it was tilting down on you. You always felt it was shifting either straight or slightly the other way. You never had to worry, hey, maybe it's coming down. Sometimes when you stand under a wall and look up, you could get the feeling it's tilting down on you. Another interesting thing that he did was that ordinarily when you build a house, so in those days, you'd build it that the window was wider on the inside than it was on the outside. So that as much light as you could get would spread out as light comes in, light refracts. Shlomo HaMelech did it the exact opposite in the temple. He had the windows where they grew wider as they went outside the temple, symbolizing the idea that we don't get the light from outside. The temple is what shines on the whole world. So that's why the windows got wider as they went externally. Shlomo HaMelech, he's building a temple, and yet there's a tradition going all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu's time, and we saw just last week that it goes back to Avram Avinu's time, that the Beit HaMikdash is not going to be eternal. And so Shlomo HaMelech prepares certain things for the destruction. When Shlomo HaMelech inaugurates the temple, so there's a discussion, what holiness did he impart on the Temple Mount, knowing that the temple he's building is going to be destroyed? And that's one of the great things. If you look
400 years in advance,
they knew it. So the Gemara discusses the holiness of the temple that Shlomo in his inauguration gave. That holiness, is it kitcha l'shaita v'kitcha l'asad lavo? Did he give it the holiness that in spite of the destruction it would remain holy, or no? He gave it holiness and he figured if it's destroyed, that holiness goes and you can walk around the Temple Mount like it was your backyard. And then there's a discussion of what happened in the inauguration of the second temple. What were you saying?
But that's not so. You can just walk around it, you know, like...
Well, it's a machlokas Rambam Ravid. So how do you know? The Rambam and the Ravid have an argument.
Well, the poskim today, it's like there are some say it's so holy you can't go. Others say, you know, it's holy you can go up, but it has to be done it. Done this way, mikvah. You know, have to be laws of wearing the leather.
So let's start again.
The Rambam say,
there's a machlokas Rambam Ravid whether it still has that holiness. And we today obviously treat it as it does.
Yes.
But we have to realize that it's a machlokas in the Mishnah, machlokas in the Gemara, machlokas in the Rishonim. So yes, today our halacha is that it does have that holiness. But that halacha is today. If you go back to the Rambam, you go back to the Gemara, you go back to the Mishnah, it was a machlokas. It wasn't agreed by everyone. So yes, today we say it retained that holiness, and they did it with the intention that even when it would be destroyed, it would retain that holiness. In lieu of that, so then the question is, if it retained the holiness, so then where may I go, where may I not go, and what level of purity do I have to have when I go there?
Right.
But what we're discussing is the machlokas that, not today's machlokas, the machlokas that goes back 1,000 years. So there's a lot to discuss, but we have to fast forward and... Bezrat Hashem, next week we will pick up with the conclusion of Shlomo's kingdom, leading us into the future of the first temple, up to the destruction.